Introduction to Shakespeare's Life and Times. Begin Part 2 of 2. Section: Shakespeare's Era, Tudor and Early Stuart England. The Tudor era begins with Henry VII, 1485 to 1509, victor in the Wars of the Roses over the last Yorkist king, Richard III, 1483 to 1485. It continues through the reigns of Henry VIII, 1509 to 1547, Edward VI, 1547 to 1553, Mary, 1553 through 1558, and ends after Elizabeth I, 1558-1603. The Stuart era begins with the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, James I, 1603 to 1625, continues with the reign of his ill-fated son Charles I, 1625 to 1649, and then, after an interregnum period in which Oliver Cromwell and his Puritans rule, it is restored in the person of Charles II, the Restoration, 1660 to 1685. A central period of English history with respect to Shakespeare and his dramas is the mid-15th century, through his own lifetime, 1564 to 1616. Henry VII put an end to the Wars of the Roses, a period of dynastic strife between the descendants of Edward III, 1327 to 1377, stretching from 1455 to Henry's ascension and even a few years after that, to 1487. In essence, the throne was tossed back and forth between the houses of Lancaster and York, with the often incapacitated Lancastrian king Henry VI, son of Henry V, victor of Agincourt, ruling from 1422 to 1461, and briefly again in 1471, and Yorkist Richard III getting rid of the heirs of his deceased brother and fellow Yorkist Edward IV, who ruled from 1461 to 1470, and then from 1471 to 1483. Richard would rule in his own right for a little over two fitful years, from 1483 to 1485. Finally, Henry, Earl of Richmond, an exiled member of the Welsh Tudor clan, married Edward IV's daughter, Elizabeth of York, to unite the two great houses. This Henry VII, of course, is the grandfather of the mightiest of English rulers, Shakespeare's own Queen Elizabeth I. So the recent political past had been one of strife and instability, with great nobles traversing England and at times treating the people with as little respect as foreign invaders might. Elizabeth I's reign, which covered Shakespeare's lifetime until his 39th year, was a time of growth, promise, and international danger for England. Her father Henry VIII's reign, 1509 to 1547, as mentioned above, swept Martin Luther's bracing Protestant Reformation into England from the continent, posing a severe challenge to the safety and consciences of many English citizens. While at first Queen Elizabeth seemed content to require only outward conformity with the new Protestant dispensation, genuine threats from the popes in Rome and from Catholic plotting led her into ever more severe means of dealing with Catholic priests infiltrating England from Europe, and with English recusants and other religious malcontents. The massive Spanish armada sent by Philip II of Spain, Elizabeth's half-brother, was sent on a mission in 1588 to crush the English navy and then invade England itself. Thanks in part to a major storm, the armada failed, but the menace was real, which meant persecution and forced secrecy for many of England's still large number of dedicated Catholics. This was a time of growing English nationalism, naval power, and exploration, with the Queen encouraging men such as Sir Walter Raleigh and Sir Francis Drake to set sail for the New World. Royal power had been much centralized from the time of feudalism, and the court was a great factor in English life during Tudor and Stuart times. But Queen Elizabeth and her successor, James I, were by no means unencumbered absolutists, however fond the latter was of the divine right of kings. In particular, the growing commercial class in London began to feel its power as an important economic force in the life of the nation. And religious Puritans began to take issue with the authority of the crown and the new Church of England, or Anglican Church, that Henry VIII had created with the 1534 Act of Supremacy, even before Pope Paul III excommunicated him, first in 1535 and finally in 1538. The struggle between Puritans and the state intensified in the reigns of the Stuart James I and then of his son Charles I, who was executed in 1649 during the course of a bloody civil war won by Oliver Cromwell and his faction, who were determined to establish the rule of the saints on English soil. These theater-closing, pleasure-disdaining Puritans ruled for only a decade or so, with Charles II returning from the continent to initiate the Stuart Restoration of 1660. But the monarchy has never been as powerful since the Puritans' regicidal interregnum. Shakespeare, of course, didn't live to see the civil strife of the 1640s, though his sister Joan did, and so did his last direct descendant, granddaughter Lady Elizabeth Hall Barnard, who died childless in 1670, 10 years after the Restoration. On the whole, during the Tudor and Stuart periods, English sovereigns were acutely aware of how valuable the arts could be to them in their quest to shore up and augment their own power, and Shakespeare and his fellow playwrights certainly benefited from this awareness. Section: London. Let's leave aside political and religious history and move on to consider Shakespeare's London. It was a thriving city of perhaps 200,000 to a quarter of a million people by his day, say 1600, and the whole of England had around 4 million inhabitants. The neoclassical critic Samuel Johnson later declared proudly that, quote-unquote, "he that is tired of London is tired of life." But even before his time, the city must have been an exciting place to live, if not a very safe one. Many of the protections modern people take for granted didn't exist in Shakespeare's time. Safe food and good sanitation? Forget it. Healthcare? Not available, aside from perhaps some herbal remedies and advice to take the waters or avoid strenuous exertion. Physicians were about as likely to kill their patients as cure them. The germ theory of disease was unknown. It's more or less a 19th century development, and the average lifespan seems to have been around 35 years. If a person was very lucky and never contracted a serious illness or needed surgery, he or she might live to the biblical 70 or 70 years, but more likely the end would come much sooner. Moreover, there was still the bubonic plague to deal with in both London and the countryside. Daniel Defoe's post-restoration book, Journal of the Plague Year, 1722, conveys how horrifying and deadly a prospect that was. Material life for London's working class of servants, apprentices, and artisans must have been rough, always a struggle. The city had its guildsmen and prosperous merchants, too, but all were subject to the difficulties of life in a noisy, dirty, dangerous environment. One thing to draw from this characterization is that life in early modern London retained some of the uncertainties of medieval times, in particular, a deep sense of the tenuousness of existence itself. People never knew when they or someone they loved would be carried off by the plague or some other sickness, or by an accident due to unsafe conditions. Death was an acknowledged, if feared, part of everyday life. That kind of awareness makes for a very different sensibility from ours, because our culture tends to distance us from the presence and processes of death. At the same time, London offered a new sense of possibility and liveliness, a sense of the larger world out there, the one beyond Europe being explored by Sir Walter Raleigh and Sir Francis Drake and others. London was becoming, to some degree, cosmopolitan. a place that invited the world in rather than excluding it. In plays such as The Tempest, Shakespeare plays to this awareness of the greater world beyond England, no doubt much to his audience's delight. Section: The Theater. The advent of the public theater in the 1570s through 1580s certainly testifies to a thriving intellectual climate in London. The Victorian critic Matthew Arnold was surely right when he mentioned Elizabethan London in the same sentence as classical Athens in this regard. In his 1866 treatise, The Function of Criticism at the Present Time, Arnold wrote that Shakespeare didn't need tremendous book learning because a lot of his acumen came from living in a culture that was alive to all that life had to offer in the early modern era. Shakespeare grew up in this heady atmosphere, and his audiences were receptive to the imaginative spectacles he staged for them. Some acting companies performed up to 12 plays a week, so they had to foster a community spirit among the actors, who didn't get much rehearsal time for their performances. Many Londoners of all classes had at least some leisure time, and aside from their attendance at crude spectacles such as bear baiting and public executions, they flocked in impressive numbers to the several theaters, the Rose, the Swan, and others, before the Globe's opening in 1599. It should be noted that the theaters were not located in areas within the City of London's jurisdiction, since the authorities frowned upon the seamy, morally suspect presence of the lower orders in and around the major playhouses. In his book Shakespeare's Audience, Columbia, 1961, Alfred Harbage, spelled H-A-R-B-A-G-E, suggests that on any given day, several thousand inhabitants probably paid a penny or more to attend an afternoon theater performance, and the demand only went away when the plague struck from time to time and closed the theaters down. Harbage also deals carefully with the question of audience composition. The most extreme characterizations of the London playgoers, to be sure, are the product of Puritan loathing. Not all of Shakespeare's groundlings were prostitutes or pickpockets, though some of them were. The acting profession wasn't considered solid in terms of class status, and women were not allowed to become actors because it was not deemed a respectable craft for them to practice. Still, respectable people, male and female, attended the London theaters, which were a meeting ground for citizens from various stations and walks of life. For that matter, Shakespeare's players strutted their stuff at times even before the nobility and monarchs at court, so drama was an interest that cut across large sections of Elizabethan Jacobean society. Theater was an impressive part of the life of a burgeoning early modern nation, and it served all of the purposes that art can and does serve. From reinforcing social mores to questioning them sharply, from praising monarchs to reminding them that they were, after all, only mortal, from delightful escapism to stark, almost unbearable realism. End part 2 of 2. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, September 24th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2023, Revised 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For Shakespeare quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition 4-volume genre-based format.